Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
It is Thursday, March 7th. Welcome back to Current State. We're glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. We come your way every weekday morning at 9 a.m. here on 90.5 WKAR. We follow up at 6 p.m. and you can catch us at noon every day on AM 870 WKAR. And you can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. We've got a great show lined up here for you today, all kinds of interesting topics. A look at the remainder of the Wharton Center season here. While all the students are away, we had time to catch our breath and catch up with the Wharton Center and other interesting, several health-related stories here today as well. I think you're going to like. But first, over the past six decades, the SS Badger has become a fixture on Lake Michigan. Since 1953, the coal-burning passenger ferry has carried some millions of passengers in their cars from Ludington, Michigan to Manitowoc, Wisconsin and back between May and October. Now, according to the Badger's website, it is the only remaining coal-fired steamship in operation in the United States. But for some years now, the Badger has been at the center of a growing environmental controversy since it dumps about 4 tons of coal ash daily into Lake Michigan as it crosses the Big Lake. An EPA decision whether to continue to exempt the Badger from ash dumping regulations should become public in just the next couple of weeks. Last week, an unscientific poll appearing in the Traverse City Record Eagle showed a majority of respondents said the EPA should refuse to extend the Badger's exemption from regulation. Hugh McDermott is Communications Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. He joins us to talk about the Badger and the larger issue of coal and coal ash. We did invite a rep from Lake Michigan Car Ferry Company, the firm that owns and operates the SS Badger, to join us. They said they don't want to comment until after the EPA has made its decision. So it's Hugh McDermott and Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State, Hugh.
Thanks, Mark.
What is coal ash? Spent coal. What is it made of?
Right. Coal ash is the residue left over after the coal burns. And it's, you know, coal-burning power plants have a lot of coal ash that they need to safely dispose of. The car ferry has a lot of coal ash also. I don't think it's burned at quite the same temperatures and in quite the same optimum conditions as a power plant, so they probably get more coal ash per ton of coal burned than the power plants. But, you know, it's problematic because it has a lot of contaminants in it. It can have arsenic, lead, mercury as part of the components of the ash. So we're essentially dumping uncontrolled toxic chemicals into Lake Michigan from the ferry.
And what do we know about the effects of that? Sounds extremely toxic, a toxic mix of elements there. What do we know about the effects of mercury, arsenic, and lead on people, animals, fish?
Yeah. Well, we know that mercury especially is a huge problem in Great Lakes waters. It's a neurotoxin. It impairs childhood development. It's one of the reasons that there are fish consumption advisories on every inland lake in Michigan because of mercury poisoning, a lot of it deposition from coal-burning power plants. If you are a woman who is pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant or possibly becoming pregnant, you really should pay attention to the mercury advisories that our state has on fish consumption. So, whether this ferry is dumping significant amounts of mercury or not, I guess the question is why are we continuing to do this after 60 years?
How much of those substances, the mercury, arsenic, and lead, does coal burning create? Could you argue these are trace amounts or are they noticeably greater?
You know, I guess it depends on the facility that's burning the coal and you know, how they're filtering it. In the coal plants, they're actually scrubbing a lot of those toxic chemicals out and collecting them and keeping them from spewing into the environment. So their coal ash probably has a larger concentration of those chemicals than the boat, which doesn't have any emissions controls on it. A lot of those chemicals end up going out into the air, which is also problematic. But, you know, whatever isn't burned ends up, or whatever is captured by the emissions control systems ends up in the coal ash and has to be handled properly.
Has the coal scrubbing movement, has that generally, how big of an impact has that had over the years? I've gotten into so many discussions about this over the years with different people, and some people maintain there is no such thing as clean coal.
No.
But at the same time, there has been this coal scrubbing technology that's become a part of the landscape. How has that played out?
Well, you know, back in the late 1970s, we passed the Clean Air Act, which is really the beginning. And in Michigan, you know, we passed some clean air legislation too, and that's really been the impetus behind taking a lot of these toxic elements out of the air and improving public health. And we've made dramatic improvements in capturing these toxic releases and you know, disposing of them at least temporarily, rather than letting them escape into the atmosphere and cause all sorts of health problems. You know, heart ailments, premature death, asthma, heart attacks, all those are related. We've made tremendous progress in clearing those out. And, the Badger is one of the holdovers. It's got a special exemption. It's kind of got iconic status. And it's been allowed to operate sort of outside the rules for quite some time now.
There's a huge nostalgia dynamic that's in play here, too. And we talked about this before we went on the air, full disclosure here. But there's something about that smokestack and the whistle and just the whole ambiance of crossing the lake on the Badger. I first did it when I was 11 years old and did it again on the Badger, not that long ago. It also provides quite an economic impact, pretty noticeable economic impact.
Yeah, I wouldn't be honest if I wouldn't say that there's a little part of me, a little part of my heart that says, wow, this is the last vestige of a bygone era. And I've been on the Badger too, made that crossing a few years ago, and it was fascinating. And it is an emotional issue for a lot of people, and it is an economic issue for the communities where the ferry docks and takes on passengers and cargo and cars. But, you know, they've had many years now to consider options. I was doing some reading last night, and I was reading old newspaper articles from the 70s and 80s where they were talking about, you know, we really need to retrofit this boat and get away from the coal because it's operating outside the boundaries of what we consider appropriate now. And the EPA gave them 4 years in 2008 to come up with a solution, and they said they would. And here we are, again, waiting to see if we're going to allow this ship to burn coal.
NPR's Noah Adams reported on the Badger this past weekend on the network, and in his story, a Ludington resident downplayed the risk of coal ash. He pointed out that when he grew up in the 60s, you couldn't look out on the lake and not see a boat not dumping coal ash. He recalled that the practice went back into the 50s and 40s, and he said, I don't remember a fish die off, and I don't remember any ecological disaster that came of that. How common is that perception? Is there a common perception that coal ash is harmless?
I certainly don't think that's a common perception. I've heard that argued in the case of the Badger, that the levels of the arsenic and the lead and the mercury and the other nasty stuff in there are too low to worry about. And I think that's really a misguided argument. I mean, you know, Michigan has a long history of figuring that its natural resources can't be compromised. We looked at the logging in the 1800s, where people said we'll never run out of timber, and we cut almost all our old growth forests. We looked at the passenger pigeon. We thought that would never go extinct, but we hunted it out of existence, and we almost lost beavers. We almost hunted them to extinction because we're looking at these resources, thinking they're inexhaustible, thinking the lake is so big that it could absorb this, and it has not turned out to be true in other cases, and we shouldn't be dumping a couple Volkswagens worth of coal ash unfiltered into the lake every day that that ferry runs. We should find a better solution.
Another important question here is the company, the Badger, the Lake Michigan Car Ferry Company, has been given 4 years to come up with an alternative. Is it realistic to assume that they should have come up with some kind of option by now?
Well, we think so, yeah. I mean, they talked about retrofitting it to liquid natural gas. There's a competing ferry that opened not long ago, the Lake Express, that runs on diesel, which is a far better alternative and a far less polluting alternative. And, you know, the technology has come. I was reading in Denmark, there is an emissions-free ferry that runs on solar, wind, and fuel cells that runs between Denmark, Sweden, and Germany and hauls cars and is bigger than the Badger. In Norway, there's an all-electric car ferry that runs. So there are plenty of alternatives. It's just a matter of willpower and you know, eventually, finally, hopefully, requiring this ferry to adhere to the same rules that the other operators play by.
I can't let you go without, pardon me, some kind of comment on this proposed biodiversity legislation from Senator Tom Casperson. Can you put that in some perspective for us?
Yeah, that's Senate Bill 78, passed out of the Senate earlier this week and will be going to a House committee next week. And its ostensible goal is to eliminate a program that Mr. Casperson and a lot of opponents of this program thought was bad, and that's a biodiversity program, which essentially would explore designating some lands for biodiversity management, genetic health of plants and animals in Michigan. And the legislation would eliminate that, but one of our big problems is it goes way farther than that. It essentially redefines conservation, prohibits the state's Department of Natural Resources for managing land specifically for biodiversity and genetic health of plants and animals, and really undercuts, 100 years of land management practice in Michigan, where we've been managing our land, recognizing that we need to preserve the native species and protect against invasive species. And it essentially is really, really bad news in the way that Michigan manages its forest.
We are making every effort to get to Senator Casperson on Current State here coming up next week. So we're pretty confident we're going to be able to do that and stir that up more with him. We've been talking about the SS Badger, coal ash, and biodiversity with Hugh McDermott, Communications Director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks so much, Hugh.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A study published in the journal Health Affairs this week shows a decline in life expectancy for American women. What exactly is causing this alarming trend? Or understanding what's causing this alarming trend could be a long way off, as scientists are perplexed by the findings. And the need for more data is further complicated by an apparent history of gender imbalance in medical research. With us to sort through some of this is Dr. Carmen Green. She's a professor of medicine at the University of Michigan and was recently named the Associate Vice President for Health Equity and Inclusion for the University of Michigan Health System. Dr. Green, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you speak to this recent study from Health Affairs? What kind of information does this give us?
Well, I think these findings are very disturbing. When you think about the amount that we spend on health care in this country, and where we've always had an increase longevity amongst women as compared to men, and now we're seeing a decrease in the life course of women. So that's really problematic and really a public health and a health policy concern.
Clinically, can you go any deeper? Do we know the particular diseases or problems that are part of this earlier mortality?
So the study didn't really address those particular issues. What they did is they looked at things at the county level, and they compared men to women. and they looked to see whether or not mortality was changing, where that is, people dying and whether or not and when they died. And they really found that, particularly in rural America, that women were living less long lives. So they also didn't really break it down based upon race or ethnicity. And there's some problems. And actually, the authors are quite good in talking about some of the concerns of their study. For instance, they talked about things at the county level. Now, if you look like a county like Washtenaw County that I live in, there's a great deal of variability between, you know, what is in the Ann Arbor area and what might be in Ypsilanti or other types of communities that may be within the same county. You could say the same thing for Genesee County, where you have Flint and you have other communities. So county-level data may not be where we want to be as we start to examine some of the underlying details of this particular study. We may want to be at the city level, or we may even want to go down to the zip code level to start sorting out some of the underlying determinants that influence these results.
The results of the study seem to open the door for a larger conversation about medical research on women's health specifically. I'm led to believe there's a long history of bias there. Is that correct, and can you give us a sense of that?
Well, there are concerns about how we do women's studies. Think about it. I mean, you know, women are not just their uterus and their ovaries, and we focus for many years just on the reproductive organs. If you look at the life expectancy of women, really aging is a women's health issue, right? So women tend to live 5 years longer than men, whether mm-hmm. you're black or you're white or you're Hispanic. So the challenge with this particular study is that it's showing that women are not living as quite as long. Now, about 20 years ago, the NIH put in place the Office for Research in Women's Health, because prior to that, it would be not uncommon for a study that may look at a new drug for heart disease and only use men. It might be common to do a study that would focus on the role of seatbelts and only do it in what we call the prototypical, the average man, which is 5'7" and about 170 pounds. Well, that doesn't take into account, you know, a woman across her lifespan. So, you know, a woman who might be 5'2" driving the same car, who may be 5'2" and pregnant, or 5'2" and 85 years of age. So that's how seatbelts were originally developed. So the Office of Research in Women's Health and a number of institutes and also the community sort of said, you know, wait a minute, we need to have work that is looking at us, at women and women across their lifespan. And that's particularly important if you think about where we are as far as the percentage of the population. So right now, the majority of the population is female. More women than men, and that number is expected to increase by 2030, where we expect this over 60% of the population to be women. So we need to be thinking really critically about women's health and where they are in their across their life course. So when I speak to that, I talk about, you know, a young child. We talk about women taking care of children, and we also think about women taking care of their family units, which is sort of prototypical. But we also think about women who now may be grandmothers who are taking care of their grandchildren.
There seems to have been more discussion, more awareness, really, in very recently on women and heart health. What can you put that in some context for us?
So that's really important because we now know that sometimes women present very differently for heart disease than men. I think one of the most, so you've asked me a little bit about the history of women's health, and one of the studies that has always been a bit disturbing is this article by Shulman, where he took actors and he compared men and women who were actors, and they were across a variety. I mean, they were people of color and people not of color. And they asked physicians to make a decision as to how they treated these people coming in with chest pain, and recognized these were actors. And so they presented with what we call the classic chest pain. It hurts here and it radiates, sort of hurts in the heart area and it radiates down the arm. That's very classic. And what was found is that physicians made very different decisions for this classic type of chest pain for men as opposed to women, where the women, and with men getting the best quality care, and women receiving lesser quality care, as well as racial and ethnic minorities. That's for the classic type of chest pain. Now, we also know that women may present very differently for their chest pain. So there's variability in what we call clinician decision-making, how doctors, how nurses make decisions about the care of women.
Given the not uncommon caretaker roles that women tend to adopt in life, later in life, often I have to assume that an earlier mortality could have really noticeable impact on the larger society. Am I correct?
Absolutely. So, you know, we certainly are changing how we do business in the home. You know, men are certainly picking up more of their fair share. But clearly, women are more likely to be providing child care. They are more likely to be the ones who make the decisions about health care in our families, for men as well as for their children. We now know that more, and also, you know, I think about the women who are sort of sandwiched, those people who have older parents, right? And you have to provide care for them. So they're getting sandwiched. And then there's the women who are grandmothers who are taking care of their grandchildren. So taking care of women is not just the right thing to do. We must do it because of the fact that it has such down river type of effects for the rest of society.
How exactly do we intervene to close this gap?
Well, I think we need to be thinking about, first of all, we need to get more data. And we have to have better research that is sort of looking at women across their lifespan. So, you know, this study gets us starting to think about, you know, maybe some of the things that we've been talking about, obesity, smoking, are starting to catch up with us. But it also says that we need to have more studies that really look at a multitude of different factors that influence the lives, the healthy lives of women. So how do doctors make decisions? How do patients have access to care? And if they have access to care, do they have good quality care? And can we expect the same outcomes for women as we do for men? And if so, then why aren't we getting them? And then, you know, maybe the determinants that we use for you as opposed to me aren't the same. Maybe we need to be doing some things a little differently. So that's the healthcare component. But we also need to think about the environments that we live in. You know, secondhand smoke. Are there other types of factors that we need to be intervening in? You know, poverty. We now know that children are growing up in more poverty. So that means by, you know, you follow the math, that also affects women because women are providing most of the care for children. So this is going to need to be sort of a team approach, multidisciplinary approach to sort of get to the root of some of these causes. And that's some of the things that we're interested in really looking at the University of Michigan.
Where can you say that larger process really ought to start? Medical school? Where?
Well, you know, a novel concept would be actually to have it start actually in the undergraduate level, actually down in the in our high schools and our grade schools. You know, how do we get young women and men into the sciences? How do we prepare them well so we have that critical brain power? How do we start making people think about living healthier lives? You know, just because your environment is not the best doesn't mean that you cannot expect to be healthy in this society. So this is really a public health issue, is a public policy issue. Clearly, we need to be training doctors and nurses and all the health science professionals better.
Very good. Dr. Green, we've got to let it go there. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Okay.
Dr. Carmen Green of the University of Michigan, many thanks.
Have a great day.
Thank you. Coming up on Current State, the remainder of the season at the Wharton Center, and Michigan nurses gathered in Lansing yesterday. We'll find out what is on their mind. Coming up on Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. A major road construction project is getting underway in East Lansing, and the work is expected to make getting through the city tougher for motorists this year. The Michigan Department of Transportation says there will be improvements on Grand River Avenue from Coolidge Road to Park Lake, and on Michigan Avenue from the west city limits to Grand River. There will be road resurfacing, sidewalk and ramp improvements, non-motorized pathways, and traffic signal upgrades. Barrels have already gone up in the streets, and the project will take until October 4th. Boy, that seems like a long time away. Here to talk with us about this project and what it means to everyone who uses these major streets, Todd Sneathen, the City of East Lansing's Director of Public Works. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's begin with the first phase of the project, work on both Michigan and Grand River Avenue simultaneously through May 5th. What is being done there?
Actually, what's being done is they are reconfiguring the Beale Street entrance into campus. That's kind of a strange intersection currently.
Yeah.
And what they're going to do, as opposed to the merge, they're going to make that into a 90-degree intersection with a traffic signal. They're also going to be prohibiting left turns at the Harrison and Michigan intersection. There's a northbound left turn right now. There's a southbound left turn, and they're going to actually prohibit those and create those Michigan lefts where you have to actually go through the intersection and make a loop around and come back the other direction.
That's going north on Harrison and attempting to make a left onto Michigan.
That's one way. Okay, yes. Okay. And then there's also the people heading eastbound on Michigan Avenue that are trying to make a left and go north on Harrison. There will be no more left turns allowed in the Harrison Road intersection. So.
Until May 5th.
They'll be allowed until probably later in the project once everything gets done. But by October 4th, they will no longer be there.
Okay. At least one lane of traffic will be open on Michigan and Grand River at all times. But won't it make getting around difficult with work being done on both at the same time?
It'll definitely make work being difficult. If you go through there right now, you know, they've got barrels and everything out. What they're primarily going to be doing in this first part, though, is really doing some concrete work, ADA ramps. I think people see those ramps quite frequently with the raised bumps that are on there, truncated domes, really, which are part of the American with Disabilities Act to make it for people with visual impairment. Those all need to be done. That's part of this project. They'll do a little bit of curb work. And then what they'll ultimately do is tear all the asphalt out and put it all back. But a lot of this work's going to be done, especially that paving is going to be done on a weekend. There's been a lot of cooperation with East Lansing and MDOT in order to try to minimize, you know, these really lengthy impacts. It's going to impact people, don't get me wrong, but trying to minimize some of those other ones where, I don't know if you've ever tried to go through some place where they're trying to put asphalt on a road and it's narrow, you just almost can't do it. So they're going to try to do this on the weekends.
What are East Lansing merchants saying about the project? Has it been on their radar long enough that they're just acclimated to it, or is this really a headache for them?
Well, it's been on their radar. It's been on the radar for almost 2.5 years, but it still doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something that we're going to have to live with. You know, like I said before, it's been a good partnership with the Department of Transportation. So our hope is, you know, this is all supposed to be done before the students come back in the fall. I know you talk about October 4th, but the vast majority, 80, 90% of the work will be done through the City of East Lansing for when move-in week starts in the fall. And I think that makes the merchants feel a little bit better about the situation.
What's that dialogue like between your office and the businesses in East Lansing?
Between my office, we really work a lot with the planning department as well. We have a downtown development authority, a downtown management board. Actually, last night we had what we call a meet and greet in the Marriott Hotel where we had people come and talk and ask questions so that they're familiar with what's going on. So,
talk about the non-motorized traffic now and in the future on the two big streets, Grand River and Michigan Avenues. Has it been a problem, and will the project improve safety for motorists and the others?
Yeah, I think it has been a problem. It's one of those things where, you know, with especially with being so close to Michigan State University, trying to find the ability for pedestrians and bicyclists, any non-motorized, to really use this area has been difficult. We're going to put in two really significant projects, the area from Bogue Street to Hagedorn. We will be building 5-foot pathways along that area on both sides of the road, improving a lot of that, which if people walk down there now, they see they're all bumpy and missing in some spots. And really what that'll be done is it's non-motorized. We'll also have mid-block crosswalk at one point, almost at Hagedorn, so people can cross and get over to the bus stop. That's a big project. That's was a tough project to do, but we've got that under control, and that's going to be starting at probably the end of July. And then the other thing is Michigan Avenue is going to be go from in the three-lane sections, which is primarily all a westbound from where Grand River intersects to the city limits. One of those lanes is going to be turned into what we call a buffered bike lane. A bike lane is going to be installed with cross-hatching to not allow other motorized vehicles in there. Been a lot of research, computer modeling, and everything been done. That Michigan Avenue does not carry enough traffic to support three lanes of traffic pavement.
Okay.
So it's about 20,000 vehicles a day travel on Michigan Avenue, but for three lanes you need closer to 40 to 45. So MDOT's pretty comfortable with that. Worked with the city of Lansing, and we're really going to provide non-motorized facilities along there. And when it comes to non-motorized, any piece you can put in at the opportunity you have, eventually you can fill in those gaps over time.
Is that the action the city council took a couple of nights ago?
That is exactly. Yeah. They took action to support that, and that's what MDOT had asked us to do.
But no work will be done on holiday weekends or at times of other major events. Is that correct?
That's correct. Football games, art festival, Great Lakes Folk Festival. That's correct.
Okay. You've also got, these four, well, Grand River from Hagedorn to Park Lake Road. Could you address that for us?
Yeah, that will be something that's going to be done in the fall, more after the students come back. It's going to be milling and paving. It'll be a lot less inconvenient. Then there's a lot more room down there than there is in some other sections.
Not an expansion.
No, there is no expansion of this anywhere.
Okay. You've also got a project that may be a little further off everyone's radar. This is involving Kalamazoo Street.
Yeah. Along Kalamazoo Street, we're going to be building a large sewer project, and that's supposed to start April 1st. And ultimately, Kalamazoo Street, I know the timing of this is horrible, but this project's been in the work for almost 5 years, will be closed for a period of time. And this is the main connection to our wastewater treatment plant.
Okay.
So we're putting an additional sewer in to provide service to the city of East Lansing, Meridian Township, and MSU.
Okay. Todd Sneathen is the city of East Lansing's Director of Public Works. A nice comprehensive review there, Todd. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Hundreds of nurses from across the state were in Lansing yesterday to lobby their state lawmakers. The Michigan Nurses Association says one of its most pressing issues is patient safety. The association says many hospital nursing units are understaffed, which threatens the quality of care patients receive. They're backing a bill that would make Michigan only the second state to establish mandatory minimum nurse-to-patient ratios. But a group representing Michigan's hospitals and health systems says the legislation oversimplifies a complex issue. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
Registered nurse Scott Nesbitt works in the recovery room at the Mercy Health Partners Hackley campus in Muskegon. That's where patients go immediately after having surgery. Generally, they're still intubated and under anesthesia when they come into Nesbitt's care, so it's important that he and his colleagues monitor each person closely. They try to maintain a ratio of no more than one nurse for every two patients. But it doesn't always work out that way. Nesbitt says the recovery room is often understaffed, and not for lack of hired full-time personnel.
Our hospital constantly sends recovery room nurses home early or outpatient nurses home early because it's slow for an hour, or they cancel shifts just to save a few dollars.
Nesbitt says oftentimes nurses handle too many patients, work double shifts, and are assigned mandatory overtime because hospitals make that their policy.
Chronic staffing isn't the exception, it's the plan for these facilities.
Nesbitt made those comments during a telephone conference call this week in support of legislation that he and the Michigan Nurses Association say would ease the pressure on overworked nurses. The Safe Patient Care Act would impose mandatory nurse-to-patient ratios on a number of hospital units, 1-to-1 for critical care units, operating rooms, and maternity wards. Non-trauma units would have one nurse for no more than 3 patients and 1-to-4 in pediatrics. The bill is sponsored in the House by Representative John Switalski from Warren and its companion piece by Senator Rebecca Warren of Ann Arbor, both Democrats. It's modeled after California's first-in-the-nation measure that sets baseline nurse staffing requirements. Switalski says since its enactment in 2004, California has seen positive change, both physically and financially.
And what we found is that hospitals have actually saved money in the long run. Less lawsuits, less readmissions, and less mistakes. And so we think that California went in the right direction, and we're going to continue to push it here in Michigan.
The Michigan Health and Hospital Association opposes the bill. Joyce Young is herself a registered nurse, as well as chief nursing officer for St. Joseph Mercy Health System Hospitals in Ann Arbor. She also serves on the MHA's legislative policy panel. She points to an opposite conclusion.
Studies in California have actually demonstrated that there has not been a correlation made between increased staffing ratios or the mandated staffing ratios and quality outcomes.
Young cites research by the American Medical Association and the Institute of Medicine as evidence against the Michigan proposal. She recently completed her own study of quality and safety benchmarks spanning 5,000 nurses in 23 states. Young says the results show that a nurse's level of education, training, and skill have a greater impact on patient safety than sheer numbers of people working the hospital floors. That's the science behind the stats. But Young says it's also a matter of math. She says a growing national nursing shortage can't justify the call for mandatory minimums.
In Michigan, we're projected to see that shortage grow over the next 5-10 years and on as all of us reach retirement age. Even if there was a correlation, there's not necessarily the numbers of nurses that are out there readily available to meet the excessive ratios mandated in the legislation.
Jeff Breslin disagrees. He's president of the Michigan Nurses Association. He believes established staffing ratios will improve working conditions at the bedside. Breslin says through formal staffing plans and set ratios, California has kept new nurses in the pipeline and even lured back frustrated burnouts.
There's a lot of information that shows there's more people going into nursing. There's more people coming back into the profession who had left during the middle of their career. And then people are staying longer in the profession. So as far as a shortage of nurses, there's not.
Specific nurse-to-patient ratios are in place in some hospitals, like Sparrow and Lansing. But that agreement came about not through force of law, but by collective bargaining. The Nurses Association worries the recent passage of Michigan's right-to-work law will diminish its voice as patient advocates. That's why it's pressing to get the Safe Patient Care Act signed into law. But the measure has had a long history of stagnation in the state legislature. It's been introduced in every House session for the last 8 years, but has failed to move out of committee. The current version has 39 co-sponsors in the House. Representative Switalski says he and Senator Warren are negotiating with their leadership to win a hearing for the bill this session, another attempt to break it free from the legislative logjam and onto Governor Snyder's desk. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's been a little quieter than usual this spring break week on the MSU campus, but next week starts the home stretch of the 2012-13 academic year, as well as the remainder of the concert season at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. WKAR's Peter Wharf chatted with Wharton Center Executive Director Mike Brand earlier this week about the breadth and depth of the performances coming to East Lansing the next few months. They started their conversation in the classics, as world-renowned flutist James Galway includes Mid-Michigan on his current global tour.
Well, that tour is coming over to the United States. I believe they are touring Europe before. So it, we kind of had the agency rerouted a little bit to sneak one in because we were made aware of that tour a little bit late. But it's actually not a bad time for us. You know, at the end of March, a lot of the basketball has been kind of defined, and they still have the Final Four yet, but we're hoping there's no big game scheduled that night. It's kind of a unique opportunity to have him touring on such an extensive tour, but it is a big anniversary tour, and his wife's with him in a small chamber ensemble.
A couple of more classical highlights that we'll touch on before we get to some of the Wharton series, and those are the season finale of one of the great works of Sergei Rachmaninoff from the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, and that's the first piano concerto, and then a very special anniversary of the Verdaere Trio coming up late in the season, I think the last in the season.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good, I mean, Rachmaninoff is, I think, a very romantic composer. It's, I think it's a nice way for them to end their masterwork series here. And the Verdaeres have been around here for decades. They do a pretty good job here on their annual concert. And then they do another taping every year sometime in June. So it's nice to have them here. They're kind of a well-established chamber ensemble here in central Michigan.
That's the Verdaere Trio celebrating its 40th anniversary with a concert. Concerts coming up throughout the year here on the MSU campus, but at the Wharton Center on June 25th. Let's step back now to one of the great jazz names of all time. That's Sonny Rollins, the great tenor saxophonist from many, many decades. He comes to the Wharton Center in May.
Right. We've tried to get him here, I think, four times. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't, he's not driven by financial resources. You know, he makes his decisions on where he is in his comfort zone. So we had him scheduled actually in the fall, and then he moved to the spring because he was doing a European tour and wanted to rest. So, but at least he kept the date. So we were very happy about that. So we're very excited to have him here. He is probably one of the giants of the old school, right. Straight, you know, blues jazz, and we tried many times to get him here. We try and bring in the most prolific jazz artist, one every year, you know, well-established jazz artist, and we've had Wynton and, you know, Diane Reeves and a lot of other of the great jazz musicians here, and it's time for Sonny to come, and he's finally accepted.
Fantastic news. Sonny Rollins on May 1st at the Cobb Great Hall at the Wharton Center. Tickets are available at whartoncenter.com. We're talking with Mike Brand, Executive Director of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts at Michigan State University. Mike, let's, in the time that remains, talk as quickly as we can about the incredible variety of big acts coming up in the remainder of the season, March through the spring. It's really mind-boggling. Everything from Green Day to Carol Burnett to Celtic Woman. There's a strong public broadcasting connection right there with the music of Celtic Woman.
The Irish ladies like playing here, so they come back every other year. We have kind of an interesting deal with them because they're the aggressive part of the relationship, and so we're happy to have them back. It's a new show.
When I am down and all my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burden be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me.
And we have our regular Broadway series, of which Catch Me If You Can is the last of the season.
I can't wait to see that. Is that a play based on the DiCaprio movie?
Yes, yeah. Almost, you know, scene by scene.
Nice.
It's funny. It's got a lot of dancing in it. If you love dancing, there's just a lot of dancers in it. The music is very contemporary. It's a really fun show, and it does follow the script of the movie. The Green Day's American Idiot, we try and bring, you know, some of the edgier Broadway. We don't necessarily put it on our season, but the season ticket holders that want August Osage County or Spring Awakening or the American Idiot can buy it in addition. But it's basically here to groom people that are really interested in that type of performing art. So the sales are going well. August Osage County did well for us. We're going to continue to do that, not necessarily, you know, so weave it into the subscription series, but it'll always be here as kind of a special. And the same with in the Payson Theater, we're really trying to develop the spoken word. Mm-hmm. And those past productions we've done with the Acting Company and Aquila Theater and the Stratford Shakespeare Festival from Ontario, Canada, we're going to continue developing those appearances here in the smaller theater because it's just totally designed for the spoken word and this type of theater. So it's a great match of art and space.
One of those includes an adaptation of the Steinbeck classic of Mice and Men coming up at the Passant Theater on March 22nd.
Right, it does. And then we're also on the tour of the Monterey Jazz Festival's celebratory year with Dee Dee Bridgewater, Kristen McBride, and a few others. Their tour is just starting on the West Coast, and they're coming across, ending up back in New York, and we're very happy with that. The opening, we have an opening guest. It'll be Jazz Band One, MSU's Jazz Band One. The Monterey Jazz Festival has this huge commitment to jazz education, mm-hmm. and every date on their tour they want to bring in a student group, a good student group. And, of course, Rodney Whittaker played with all these people, right. So they know him and the type of work he's been doing here at Michigan State. So MSU's Jazz Band One will open the program. We'll have a short intermission, and then the Monterey Jazz Festival team will come out and knock your socks off.
Much remains at the Wharton Center here in March, April, May, and beyond. Mike Brand is the executive director of the Wharton Center, and you can still find tickets at whartoncenter.com. Mike, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Now Filthy can play. He's leading the way. Now all of you guys can watch to what he has to say. Now Filthy is fast, he's making mad. He's made a bomb with Dizzy and Mom. And Bud was the first to give out the news that this guy could swing and play some blues. He got the super funky sound. He can really get down. What is his name? Filthy Mac Nasty. Oh, you never get bored when he runs the course.
And we're sorry to have to report that the Sonny Rollins performance you just heard about has been canceled. That was just announced late yesterday. Sorry for any confusion. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll explore the pros and cons of self-publishing for all you aspiring writers out there. Plus, we'll have an interview with a violin prodigy from Ann Arbor and check in with MSU hockey as they enter the CCHA playoffs. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Aaron Young and Dan Drolet for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-